May it please the Court, Honorable Judges and Chief Justice Russell, I'm Jim Meadows from Lathrop & Gage, and we represent appellants Dr. Krikor Partamian and Phoenix Urology of St. Joseph. First, on behalf of myself and Dr. Partamian, thank you for agreeing to take our appeal directly from the Circuit Court to analyze this question that, as we understand it, is one of first impression in Missouri. Does the right to trial by jury under the Missouri Constitution, Article 1, Section 22A, include the right to use remediator? And how does that line up with RISMO Section 538.300's denial to parties in medical negligence cases of the ability to use remediator after a trial? Irrespective of all the other issues in this case, and indeed there are some, points relied on number 2 through 4 raise some serious evidentiary issues. Those are relatively straightforward, and I believe the Court, unless it has some questions for us on that, is more than comfortable analyzing those on the written briefs we've both submitted. I would like to focus our argument today on the issue of the constitutional right to remediator. Once this Court answers that question, all other issues fall into place. If the answer is yes, that there is a right to remediator guaranteed under Article 1, Section 22A of the Missouri Constitution, and under the right to trial by jury, this case is over. It should be remanded back to the Circuit Court to determine defendant's remediator motion and decide that issue. If this Court decides that there's not a right to trial by jury, then we can turn to a right to trial by jury for remediator. We can then turn to the remaining questions.
Counsel, this Court did away with remediator. All the way, completely eradicated it, and the legislature came back in a subsequent session and restored it, correct?
Yes, Your Honor, if you're referring to the Firestone case.
Right.
I'm happy to get in that. I knew that'd be one of the major questions.
When the legislature came back to restore remediator after the Firestone case, could it have said in that bill, we are restoring it for all actions except medical malpractice actions?
The legislature could have done so, and it did not. And I want it to be very...
If that's so, then why wouldn't the jury trial right you're positing today have been violated then?
Well, and that's frankly, Your Honor, something I'd wanted to talk about. I want it to be plain today. We believe the Firestone case was decided wrongly by this court in 1985. And in being decided wrongly and in not analyzing the constitutional issue, there's really three ways that this can be looked at. First, if you look at the Badiman versus Catering St. Louis case that this court handed down, I believe in 2013, it talks about how once the statute was enacted restoring remediator, it was as though the Firestone case was, quote, a nullity. Second, we've got some strong case law from other states that talks about how the common law comes back when a statute is enacted, restoring it as though the intervening case had never occurred.
What was the language of the statute? Do you have the exact language of the statute, the post-Firestone statute? That's okay. We'll look it up.
Not with me, Your Honor.
No, that's fine. I can look it up.
From a jurisprudential standpoint, why does that make any sense at all? That if the legislature passes a statute, that they somehow ordained a reemplacement of every case that interpreted an entire subject or doctrine?
Well, from that standpoint, Your Honor, the legislature knew what it was doing, and we presume the legislature knows what it's doing when it enacts laws. We presume that it knows the underlying background. And here it chose to bring back remediator directly addressing the Firestone.
Why isn't that statute really long that deals with every pre-remediator case? Why doesn't it make more sense to believe that they intended to do what they said they did and nothing else?
We've always presumed the legislature knows the context, and in the Badiman case, you talked about for the court how in reenacting that statute, the legislature brought back much of those pre-Firestone precedences. There's also a second way.
You're saying that the word remediator had an established meaning, and when they used it, they must have used it in a normal context.
The remediator had an established meaning. remediator has an established principle, but it goes beyond that, Your Honor. If this court was wrong, like we believe it was when it argued and decided the Firestone case in 1985, it itself violated the Missouri Constitution in Article...
Counsel, can you point me to any case? The cases I'm familiar with say that there's a right to jury trial, and we held that a legislatively imposed cap in Llewellyn violated that right to jury trial. And we held that common law traditional remediator does not violate the right to jury trial. I'm not familiar with any case that said remediator is part of the right to jury trial. This would be an issue of first impression you're asking us to hold. Is that correct?
In Missouri, it would be, Your Honor. Other states have.
Is there anything in our prior cases that suggests that part of the right to jury trial is remediator, as opposed to that the judge's exercise of judicial remediator is not a violation of the right to jury trial? If it was part of it, that issue would never come up. You couldn't violate something you're a part of.
There's two different answers to that question. First, you are correct. A direct holding in that direction would be a case of first impression in Missouri, and we are asking the court to so hold today. But I think you can also see that this and the issue of remediator being an integral part of the right to trial by jury when you read the Watts case in detail, when you read Judge Wolf's...
But you're arguing, aren't you, that it's a violation of your right maybe to due process not to have that considered, not that it's a violation of the jury trial right.
No, we're arguing that it's a violation of the right to trial by jury.
But all the cases that say that it isn't, that say that remediator itself is not a violation of the right to the jury trial, say that it isn't because it comes along with an option for a new trial, and the right of the trial court to order a new trial is as old as the right to trial by jury itself. It didn't say that it was a part of the right to jury trial. It's that the option kept it from violating the right to jury trial.
Missouri cases have not gone that far.
But we're dealing with Missouri law here, so
well,
you're asking
has
us
not,
to overrule. It's not just it's an issue of first impression. We would have to overrule all those cases. Why? Tell us why we should reconfigure our understanding of the right to jury trial at this point.
The Firestone case, which is really the only one that would have to be expressly overruled, the Firestone case did not analyze whether a remediator was part of the right to trial.
Well, we have to rule over all these cases that Judge Wilson just referred to and I was referring to, wouldn't we, that talked about you have the right to jury trial and then you have remediator, and is remediator a violation of the right to jury trial? And it's been held not to be for the reasons Judge Wilson just said. That whole analysis would disappear if you were correct that it was part of the right to jury trial.
It would not make that analysis disappear. It's complementary to it. Remediator doesn't violate the right to jury trial. That's been held by courts in other jurisdictions. That question has not come up before in Missouri. And that has been held by courts in other jurisdictions. It's been held by the Eighth Circuit in the Slayton versus Martin K. Eble construction case, and by the Supreme Court of Maryland in the Turner versus Washington Suburban Sanitary Commission case, that the remediator is an integral part of the right to trial by jury as much as many of the other functions of the right to trial by jury is. This court in Watts talked about the only limit and the only cap that could be placed on damages awarded to a plaintiff is remediator.
But if I understand your argument, you're saying it's not fair to have a right to jury trial without remediator because what if the jury verdict is beyond what's fair and reasonable? A trial judge always has a right to grant a new trial.
That is
so,
correct.
So there's, it's not that there's no control of the unusual circumstance where a jury verdict simply has no grounding in the evidence. So, that seems more due process. You're arguing not that it's a part of the right to jury trial, but that the right to jury trial without some kind of outside check violates your client's due process rights, some other kind of rights, not your jury trial right.
Due process was not before the trial court below.
Oh, I understand.
So
but
I'm not
wondering
making that argument here. If this court were to find that this is a violation based on the case we were talking about earlier, that was before the court, the one that was just argued, that remediator is part of due process, I do think that those arguments flow definitely in my client's favor here and in them being allowed to use remediator. This is a little bit of a different situation. In the case you were just dealing with, it was with punitives, and the U.S. Supreme Court and the State Farm case have made decisions controlling the amount of punitives. Here we're dealing with non-economic damages, so the analysis is slightly different. I also think a relevant factor to look at on remittiture here is that it is part of the right to trial by jury, because the right to trial by jury, as this court has said on numerous occasions, includes far more than just simply the right to have 12 people sit in lousy chairs and decide the facts of the case. It includes all the incidences and consequences of that historic right. And when you look back at the long case history we've cited here, remittiture has been an integral part of that. The right to trial by jury is one of the right to a properly functioning jury. And remittiture serves a very different purpose than just granting a new trial. If you look at the case law, remittiture is to be used in the situation where a jury makes a good faith error, not as to liability, but as to the amount of damages. Here, we're arguing, and when you grant a new trial, you have to cite that there was actually some error that occurred that caused the jury to make a bad decision, and frankly, you have to retry both damages and liability. Remittiture is designed to take care of the situation where a jury just, for whatever reason, got too generous. And that's what its purpose
well,
in the
what,
case
what about, is. What about the fact that it's tied to the trial judge's one-time ability to find that the jury's result was against the weight of the evidence? Not that there wasn't sufficient evidence, but that it was against the weight of the evidence. And we let trial judges do it one time as a release valve.
Your Honor, I think that's one of the ways that remittiture has an effect, and I think that's one of the things that it's tied to in the case law. But remittiture is an extra protection of the right to trial by jury because it allows the plaintiff to make the choice, protecting both the plaintiff and the defendant from a cost of retrial if it wishes to reduce its damages or not.
But you bring the point that it's the plaintiff who has that choice.
That choice benefits, I'm over the time, do you want me to go ahead
yes,
and answer?
Please.
The plaintiff has that choice, but remittiture is designed to protect both plaintiff and defendant, and the right to trial by jury guaranteed by the Missouri Constitution.
But you can't control the plaintiff's choice of remittiture versus new trial.
No, you
so
cannot.
So why do you have a right to say somehow it violates your right to jury trial if plaintiff no longer has it, doesn't have that choice?
It violates the defendant's right to jury trial because the defendant in that case gets a benefit. They either end up paying the reduced damages or they get another bite at the apple to try to get the damages lower.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court, Paul Redfern for Doug Stewart. And I'll address this issue of remittiture. When you look at the Constitution, of course, and as this court has held, the right of jury trial as heretofore enjoyed shall remain inviolate. Now, we've looked at what heretofore enjoyed means, and we know that it means that causes of actions that existed at the time of the Constitution, that you have a right to a jury trial. And then when we look at the second aspect of it is the scope of that right to jury trial is allowed to be restricted, not required, restricted to the extent that it existed at common law. And whether remittiture actually existed as we know it today and we talk about it today, existed at common law in 1820, I think is very doubtful. If you review those cases, they were primarily cases dealing with account or jurisdictional issues where the plaintiff would remit in order to maintain jurisdiction or there would be an error in account. But notwithstanding that fact, the fact remains that if you look at remittiture as existing as and it existed as, under common law, Firestone dealt with that issue. And, of course, the court has the right under common law to have remittiture, and Firestone looked at this issue. And as one that goes back to those days, and I can remember those days, remittiture was really applied inconsistently. And the Firestone case explained that in and of itself in some of the higher regency cases where you'd have differences in the reduction of the verdicts, which didn't make any sense. So they abolished the common law doctrine of remittiture. And all that has happened is that the legislature can choose to modify the common law and reinstate remediator. And they have done that, except in the case of medical malpractice cases, and they are still entitled to do that. But I think if there's...
Would you agree with the appellants that in whatever it was, 1987, when the legislature put remediator back, that they could have carved out med mal then?
They could have, but they also can do it later.
Well, is there any constitutional distinction between doing it then and doing it later?
Not in my mind, not at all. The legislature can modify the common law as they so choose.
There was a bargain, right? There was a bargain involved, and they added additor.
They did. In 1987, there was discussion in the legislature, and there was additor was added to the remediator statute. That's correct. And then in, I believe it was 2005, if I'm correct, they wrote the statutes with respect to medical malpractice. And at that time, they did not include remediator as being available in a medical malpractice case. And they can modify the common law through statute in that respect. But but remediator has never been held and never been recognized as a fundamental right to jury trial. In fact, that would make no sense. If we were to say that, then what we're saying is, yes, you have a right to a jury trial, but at the same time, we're going to turn it over to one judge, one person, to decide whether or not your verdict is correct. And that violates the very principle of the right to jury trial. And this court...
So if you say the remediator is contra to the right to jury trial being inviolate, a statute can't modify the Constitution.
And that may be an issue for another day. In this case, it was not remitted. But that very well may be the case. And I think there's serious questions as to whether remediator existed. That really depends on whether remediator is a doctrine that was existing in 1820. If it is, all it does and all it says is that the courts are permitted to use the doctrine of remediator. It does not require the doctrine of remediator. It does not make it a fundamental part of the right to jury trial. And that's what the case law provides.
Before Firestone, was there any ground on which an appellate court could find an error for refusing to order remediator as an option for a new trial?
Before Firestone, well, the case law before Firestone did allow remediator. There was common law remediator. Maybe I'm...
Well, would an appellate court have ever been able to say it was error for a trial court not to order remediator as an option?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. The trial court always has the power to control the verdict. In this case, the trial court could have set this verdict aside as against the greater weight of evidence. This trial court also could have set it aside as being excessive and had that power to do that. They have their right to a jury trial preserved, appropriately supervised by the court.
Opposing counsel says that it is defendant had the right to have remediator be part of the right to jury trial. Is that a right of the defendant, or does defendant have standing to raise the remediator issue, or is that an issue for the plaintiff to choose between remediator and versus a new trial?
It is absolutely the right of only the plaintiff to choose either accepting the remediator or the new trial. The defendant has no standing in that.
Can
in
defendant
that
control that in any way, plaintiff's choice? Does defendant have any input? Can defendant control plaintiff's choice of whether to accept remediator or do a new trial, or is that solely for plaintiff?
It is only the plaintiff's decision to either accept the remediator or choose a new trial.
Thank you. Well,
but what they're saying is they're in a box now. They would never have been in with remediator, common law or statutory, before it was excluded from med mal cases. And the box is they can't get a new trial unless it's against the weight of the evidence or excessive. although they could have gotten a new trial if the court had ordered remittitor and the plaintiff had taken the new trial option. So that was a, there was an aspect, there was an alternative for a new trial that was broader than what they're left with now. Does that make any sense? And why isn't that detriment to them? Why haven't they lost in this?
That process? Is not a fundamental aspect of having a right to jury trial. That goes to the procedures by which they can go to the court to ask them to either set aside a verdict or to set it aside against the greater weight of the evidence. But there's nothing in the common law that says that they are entitled to remittiture. Nothing. Never has been. There is nothing in the common law that, as it existed in 1820, that said you are entitled to remittiture, because you're not. And to say that you are is really antithetical to the right to jury trial, in essence. But having said that, they had their procedures and they were protected. At common law, a common thing was that you could get a verdict set aside as being excessive, and you get a new trial. They're protected from that, from a common law standpoint. But there is no case that holds that remittiture is a fundamental aspect of the right to jury trial.
But could the court order remittiture in a case where it could not have simply ordered a new trial because the verdict was excessive?
Under our statute, 537068, as exists now, they can.
And what are the grounds for remittiture, and how do they overlap with the right to a new trial?
Well, what the court can do is either order remittiture, and the plaintiff, if it does not accept it, then they get a new
trial.
But
the court can't just willy-nilly order remittiture. Certain conditions have
No, the court cannot just willy-nilly. There are factors to be considered.
What are the grounds for remittiture?
The grounds for the remittiture is you look at verdicts in similar areas. You look at the nature and extent
and
of the
injuries.
And
what are you looking for? Was it excessive, or what's the question?
It's excessive.
It's excessive in the mind of the judge.
And is that a ground in itself for ordering a new trial, or is that, I think it's the question.
Well, once the judge makes the decision.
Yeah, but if you don't offer an alternative or remittiture, could a court just say, I think it's excessive, I'm granting a new trial, or is that not a ground for a new trial?
They can. They can set it aside as against the greater weight of the evidence.
On damages.
They could, on the whole case. They would do it on the whole case.
One time.
And then they also, and really this is consistent with our Constitution. They can also order a new trial if they determine that the damage award is excessive, plus there was error in the case that led to the verdict being excessive. And if you
that gets you what?
That gets you a new trial.
Okay.
Defendant does.
Right.
And that is absolutely consistent with the role of the courts and the role of the legislature and the role of the jury. Because under those circumstances, when the court orders a new trial because there's error that led to excessive damages, they are not interfering with the right to jury trial and the jury's determination of damages, but exercising the court is exercising its role in supervising to make sure that the defendant gets a fair trial.
And didn't the trial court do that here by analyzing it under 7810?
That's exactly right. That's why it's kind of frustrating, because if you look at the order, the judge looked at this under 7810 anyway and determined that remittiture was not warranted.
Well, that's
overruled the case from a standpoint of being excessive damages as well.
That's the problem. If there wasn't ground for a new trial, then there wouldn't have been grounds for remittiture, even if the statute had allowed it.
That's right. If the statute did not allow it, there would not be remittiture. And that's because remittiture, when we look at the right to jury trial as it existed in common law, even if remittiture was recognized at that time, that does not make it a fundamental part of the right to jury trial. It just says you can modify a verdict as it existed at that time.
And what does the record show here about why the trial court denied remittiture?
The trial court was asked at the lower court level to rule it under 7810, 537068 as well. And if you look at the court's order, the courts and they had asked for remittiture specifically in their motion for new trial under 537-068, and the court specifically addressed that issue, saying remittiture was denied under 7810, which is
the rule. So you're saying the court, it appears from the order that the court denied remittiture not because it thought it couldn't grant it, but because it thought it wasn't warranted.
That's how I interpret the order, because there would be no reason to put in there otherwise. Why would you even specify under
the rule
7810? I mean, there would be no reason to do that. You would just deny the motion. Unless there are other questions about remittiture, I think I would just end up by saying that with the remittiture has never been a part of our jurisprudence as being a part of the right to jury trial. All our jurisprudence provides, as heretofore enjoyed, is that whatever was recognized, whatever doctrines were utilized at the common law by the courts at that time, that was okay. It was allowed. It wasn't mandatory. The appellant didn't respond, address the other issues in this case. I would simply say that the evidentiary issues, this case was a well-tried case. There was no error in the admission of Dr. Reardon's testimony. And if I may be indulged for just a minute to say that this case, they emphasize that this case was all about Dr. Reardon. This case was not about that. This case was about the man that came in on that Monday with an abscess the size of a golf ball. And Tuesday, urology's consulted. Wednesday, urology's consulted. They had done a CT scan on Monday. They did another one on Wednesday. And it had not changed. And meanwhile, all the other doctors were saying, when are you going to drain this? What are you going to do? And then on Thursday, urology didn't even see this patient. He turned south at that time in a bad way. And then on Friday, Dr. Reardon says, why don't we drain this thing, based on his experience? And it wasn't done. And there was the big issue, the big defense in this case was that it was pulmonary problems, the reason not to drain it. And that's what the big issue was. And there was no discussion of that between Dr. Reardon and Dr. Partain.
Can I clarify what Dr. Reardon's role was? Did he just happen to be walking down the hall?
No, he was seeing the patient with Dr. Partain. He was one of the partners in Phoenix Urology.
So he was treating?
He was a treating physician and actually wrote the progress note on that Friday.
Okay, thank you.
And the evidence that we admitted was to explain his background and his experience, as well as his relationship to Phoenix Urology. My time's up, I see.
Thank you, counsel.
Counsel, don't we have to rule in your favor on point four, which is the excessive verdict question, to even get to the constitutionality of the statute taking remittiture away?
No, Your Honor. And there's three separate reasons for that. First, some of the case law we cite in the brief talks about the unique role remittiture plays. Remittiture plays the role of allowing the judge to set aside an excessive verdict even if there isn't an error that caused that verdict, where the jury was simply too generous. So that's the first step on that. Second,
And that's different from a new trial. It can't order a new trial because the jury verdict was excessive.
The jury verdict can only be ordered if there was some error that led to the excessive verdict. When you look at the case law on excessive verdicts, it's fairly clear that you have to tie that with some error. You'll see in our point relied on
why,
four.
Why isn't that question resolved by the issue that the common law is determined by the courts? Remittiture can be given and taken away based upon the idea that it's either used within a range or it's not used within a range. And at some point in time, this court felt like the trial courts were becoming so inconsistent that they took that discretionary tool away.
As this court has pointed out in the LaPlante versus Demure case, the common law evolves, the common law changes. And this court has that historic power as a common law court to change the common law as it changing circumstance warrants. However, we have the Missouri Constitution as an overarching overlay on that. Article 1, Section 22A provides that the right to trial by jury remains inviolate. That's not just a right for the plaintiff. That's a right that protects the defendant as well. And one of the historic, deeply ingrained, long history parts of the right to trial by jury is the right to a remediator and the ability to use remediator. This court had asked earlier, and I believe it was Judge Wilson, is there any case where a court has been reversed for not considering remediator? I apologize that I don't have it in front of me at the moment, and the timer's not actually running. So I have no
never
idea.
Argue with the
just keep talking.
Well,
just
I'm
keep
fine talking. With that, but it's just that moment of
you
war.
Got 3 minutes
if
now,
you
go
leave
for
me,
it.
I'll draw talk the rest
minutes.
Of the day. There are cases in the antebellum period that we cite in our brief. Some of those were reversals of the trial courts in Missouri for not using remediator. And it's true, remediator took a different form in the antebellum period. Often remediator would deal with other issues, a collection issue or something like that. But its heart and its core remain the same, that you were reducing the amount of damages awarded because they were undue. They were
excessive. Can you have extra time? Yeah, go ahead.
I want to go back just for a second on whether or not you preserved the constitutional issue.
Yes.
Didn't in your answer you deny that 538-300 was unconstitutional?
That is accurate.
Okay, so have you preserved this issue at the earliest opportunity?
Yes. Remediator does not come into issue until an excessive verdict is entered. Here an excessive verdict was entered, and the issue of whether that section of the statute was valid was raised at that time immediately. If you want to look back at that issue, the constitutionality of the statute was in question because plaintiff had raised it themselves. So that issue was already in the case at that time.
But until it was excessive, there was no point to arguing
about
that it needed to be remitted because you can't anticipate what the jury would do.
Right.
But here, I've got two questions related to issues raised by opposing counsel that now you have this newfound time to answer. One is that the judge's ruling mentioned the rule, 7810, did not mention the statute. So if the court, for whatever reason, did not, it appears by doing that the court thought it had authority to remit under the rule and yet chose not to do so, which would make all the arguments about the statute not really material here. And the other one also deals with materiality. If the verdict's not excessive, we don't get to this, so can you very briefly address why a verdict that's greater than requested is necessarily excessive, which seems to be your argument?
Sure, Your Honor. Let me take your first question first. I think respondent is being very generous with how they read the trial court order. It's one short sentence saying remediator is denied and citing
but
to
it
the
does
rule.
Cite the statute. It cites the rule.
It does cite to the rule. Plaintiff was very smart in submitting that one to the trial judge. And I don't know that that's the case, but, you know, when you read the transcript, you can tell, and we cite in our briefs, the conversation between my client's attorney at trial and the judge. It was very obvious from the comments that the judge did not believe he had the authority to grant that the arguments about remediator, you're going to have to raise those with somebody higher up, which is exactly what we're doing here.
Well, didn't have the authority because of the statute excluding it from MedMal, or didn't have the authority because there wasn't an excessive verdict?
In the discussion, it's obvious they're talking about the MedMal statute because they're talking about the constitutionality. And I'm sorry, Judge Stith, I can't remember your second question.
Your verdict on excessiveness seems to be because it was more than it was asked for, it must be excessive.
Well, and that gets back to what this court needs to do about it. This court is not being asked to remit the case in and of itself. It's being asked to have the trial court analyze it under remediator. There is solid case law, the Lewis versus Envirotech case, that says one of the factors you can look at is did the jury award more than the plaintiff requested. Here, that definitely occurred. It occurred by over $1 million. And there's even some stronger language on that in closing argument where plaintiff's counsel had said, you know, you could award 10 times the damages, but I think that would be unfair in this case, that would be excessive. Well, what we're looking at is around 10 times. Now, I think you can read that in context as him talking 10 times medicals and we were talking 10 times for the non-economics here. So
right.
there is some back and forth on that. But there are grounds that remittitor could be granted by the trial court, and that's really a decision the trial court needs to make instead of one that this court has to
well,
make.
Well, under point four, though, what makes it error not to have ordered a new trial because it was an excessive verdict?
There are two trial errors that led to prejudice. And I think the key one is Dr. Reardon's testimony you just heard about from plaintiff. Dr. Reardon was brought in solely for one purpose and one purpose only, to say that he would have treated plaintiff differently. His testimony was varying the standard of care, and his testimony was also testimony of what his personal practice in the situation
would be. If he was a treating doctor, why, I mean, we always let in treating doctors about the condition and prognosis of the patient. Why isn't it relevant for that purpose, not for standard of care? He's not somebody brought in that didn't have a relationship to the patient.
Well, first, that's not the argument of why plaintiff said that they used it. They said that they used it just to explain the context. Second, I think it's very obvious from the transcript and in this case that it doesn't relate to explaining the prognosis and diagnosis. There's no reason for him to testify, I had another one of these cases at this same hospital a week earlier and I drained it. There's no reason for him to have testified that I have had five of these in my career and I drained all of them. That's the error that was made. That's the varying from the standard of care. And that's the testimony that plaintiffs sought to highlight not only in opening argument, not only in the examination of the doctors, but also in their closing arguments.
Thank you, counsel. The matter will be taken under submission.